Welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, a career prosecutor from the Savannah, Georgia area. We are continuing our series on the murders of J.R. and Mary Crocker at the hands of their family. Over the last seven episodes, we've detailed the mounds of evidence the investigation uncovered against Ellen Crocker, Candace Crocker, Kim Wright, Mark Wright, and Roy Prater. From December 20th of 2018 onward, no statement of Ellen Crocker denied his responsibility for the deaths of his children. So why did it take until 2026 to resolve these cases? And why did they end the way that they did? The short answer is mismanagement by the courts, and of course also by the DA's office. We'll cover the DA's office in the next episode. The longer answer requires a look at some history, the law, and how judges, whose job it is to make decisions, get away with not doing that. The Crocker family was indicted early in 2019. Attorneys were appointed, and the DA's office gave notice of its intention to seek the death penalty against all five defendants, making these cases capital cases. And in capital cases, the rules are different. By the rules, I'm not talking about the Constitution. As Rick Daly would say, the Constitution is the Constitution. It applies to every case, from speeding tickets to capital cases. But capital cases get more scrutiny. And as they involve taking a life, more safeguards have been put in place in those states in the U.S. that have the death penalty than any other place in the world. This is not going to be a discussion of the morality of the death penalty or even a deep dive on all of the legal history that got Georgia to the point that it is with capital litigation, but some context is necessary. In 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case called Furman versus Georgia, signaling that Georgia was not doing enough to protect capital defendants, and a death penalty moratorium was put in place. 4 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court decided Gregg versus Georgia, which lifted that moratorium, saying the death penalty is not an Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment violation, provided the courts follow proper procedures. To that end, the Georgia Supreme Court created a procedural structure for capital cases called the Unified Appeal in 1980. The main parts of this structure have been unchanged since approximately 1988. If you go to court to watch a hearing in a capital case, you will hear the judges ask things about the attorney's experience and training, whether motions have been filed, and whether the defendant is satisfied with the services of their lawyer. While many of these procedures have been subverted over the years, as we will discuss, the purpose of the procedures was primarily to ensure that defense attorneys were doing their jobs for their clients. As an aside, there is a huge body of case law in all manner of cases addressing what is called ineffective assistance of counsel. The idea is to ensure that defense counsel is not so incompetent they amount to a violation of a client's Sixth Amendment right to counsel. That will not be covered here in any detail. But this backdrop matters because studies done of capital cases from 1976 on led to the creation in Georgia of the Multi-County Public Defender's Office in 1992. That office was designed to pool resources from Georgia counties to provide indigent defense to capital defendants. The idea being that a person in a poorer county who couldn't afford an attorney would get the same quality of representation as a defendant in a richer county. All good so far, right? Except that the money stream wasn't even. There were allegations of mismanagement and lack of accountability, especially from the counties that were putting more money into the system. Part of the financial issue was that the multi-county public defenders got a base salary but charged various counties in which cases were assigned for supplements and sometimes hourly rates, even though motions being filed were duplicates and took no more time to prepare than changing the names on the style of the motion. Yet they were being charged the same amount as drafting it. Some of this was deliberate strategy to bankrupt the smaller counties and dissuade them from seeking the death penalty. So to manage that issue, the Georgia legislature created the Capital Defender's Office in 2005. These attorneys would have a state salary, and there would be regional offices assigned to cases to reduce travel expenses. The resources were pooled and state paid. Again, all good, right? Not really, as you will see. Because the capital defenders were to be involved in all capital cases, if there was more than one person involved in a case and the death penalty was sought, potential conflicts of interest required capital defenders from other regions to be assigned. While this shouldn't be a big deal, since once the death penalty is sought, each defendant is to be handled separately, scheduling invariably became a nightmare. Why? Because the capital defender's entire strategy, in most cases, is to delay trial as long as possible. And if people are unavailable, so much the better. Much of that strategy is played out in the filing of literally hundreds of motions. While some of these motions are what we call substantive motions, motions on which evidentiary hearings are always required, like motions to suppress evidence seized or statements given, perhaps 10 of the motions filed by the capital defenders fit this actual category. The remainder are variations on things like motion to have civilian bailiffs, motion not to allow law enforcement to appear in court in uniform, motion to limit courtroom security, etc. Every subject that they could dream up would have 6 motions filed with varying wording, all beginning with paragraph upon paragraph of how the defendant is, quote unquote, on trial for his life. Death is different, and citations to the 8th Amendment cruel and unusual clause. If asked, capital defenders would say they needed hearings on every single motion, and at the hearing date would either be unprepared or read the motion as filed verbatim. Each defendant would file the same motions, but they would put their numbers in different order so that you couldn't simply cut and paste responses. Motion upon a motion filed by the capital defenders were filed based on law that had long been decided against the position that they were taking, like claims that children are not competent witnesses or the death penalty is unconstitutional. But rather than courts calling them out for wasting their time or ruling upon boilerplate motions about courtroom security without a hearing, judges indulged these tactics. You may be thinking, well, are they entitled to a full hearing on everything? Actually, no. Ethical rules imposed upon all attorneys require lawyers to notify the court of law contrary to their position. Obviously, if the lawyer doesn't know about that law, they can't notify the court. But in the case of the capital defenders, since they, at least since 2005, were the only litigators involved in cases involving the death penalty and where these rulings were made against their positions, they knew. In filing motion upon motion, no mention was made of any rulings against their positions, let alone how many there were. It was also standard capital defender practice to ask for evidentiary hearings on things like the importance of jury instructions, then call experts, where someone with a PhD would get paid a large sum of money and travel expenses to testify about those studies we've already talked about from the cases in the 1980s, where jurors may not have understood the instructions they were given. All of this data being things gathered from the juror interviews done years after the fact. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is your tax dollars at work. But let's make it clear, those are state tax dollars, not tax dollars belonging to one specific county. So how about this push for hearings on hundreds of motions? Going back to 1999, the Georgia Supreme Court has made clear that evidentiary hearings are not required on motions where the law is well settled against the defendant. Yet many of these same motions that had been denied without a hearing all the way back to 1999 were still being filed by the capital defenders on the Crocker cases with no acknowledgement of their decades of legal denials. Why on earth would any judge, let alone multiple judges around the state, tolerate such unethical behavior? Could it be incompetence, laziness, apathy, or just straight fear of being reversed? The judge assigned to the Crocker cases at their inception was Judge Gates Peed, the chief judge of the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit. Judge Peed, by the time I arrived in the circuit in 2022, had an exceptional reputation for being decisive and moving his dockets. Yet by the time I got involved in this case in July of 2022, he had only ruled on 23 motions. How could this be? This case was almost 4 years old. I failed to mention a couple of other capital defender tactics: delayed filings and lying about discovery. The capital defenders had entered appearances on these cases in 2019. The attorneys representing Candace and Roy had quickly negotiated deals, exchanging truthful testimony for taking the death penalty off the table. So it would be unfair to lump those lawyers in with the rest. In fact, Roy's attorney was not even a capital defender at all, just a lawyer who saw the writing on the wall and advised her client to tell the truth. While she later made unsubstantiated claims about the sentence that was to be imposed on Roy, it ended up being irrelevant because Roy died before he could be deposed for trial. The remaining six lawyers, have I mentioned that two capital defenders must be present for every court date, put the D in delay. The state rarely gets to decide much when it comes to how and when cases are tried, but one of the few scheduling decisions it can make is which of several co-defendants goes to trial first. Early on, the state made it clear that it intended to try Alwin Crocker first, to be followed by Kim and then Mark. Is it a surprise, then, that the first motion filed by the capital defenders in Alwin's case was not filed until February 28th of 2020, and that was just one to allow Alwin to come to court in civilian clothes with nothing else? Yes, we have to admit, COVID intervened. But all courts had e-filing by this time, and the Ogeechee Circuit did not do the moratorium on in-person court for as long as many other court systems did. Hearings were scheduled in October of 2020. Full discovery was served on all defendants no later than November of 2020, which included DNA data. Judge Peed entered his first scheduling order requiring all motions to be filed by February the 1st of 2021, and requiring any extension of the deadlines to be requested in writing. Mark Wright's attorneys filed approximately 75 motions by that deadline. Kim Wright's attorneys filed about 20 motions by then. Elwin Crocker's lawyers filed none beyond that first single motion that they had filed back in February 2020. Surprised? You shouldn't be. The capital defenders, though, technically conflicted out of and walled off from each other's cases when a conflict existed, knew the state wanted to try Elwin first and thought they could distract the court from trying Elwin's case by loading up with motions on Mark Wright's case. By March the 1st of 2021, Elwin's attorneys did file their first 40 motions, but none of the motions filed in any of the cases by any of the capital defenders was a substantive motion. Nothing at this point appeared to be happening on the criminal side of this case. There was a status hearing in July of 2021, and still nothing. The second attorney for Elwin quit, so motion hearings that had been scheduled in October of 2021 got delayed. This will become a theme. But things were happening related to the deaths of these children on the civil side of the legal world. In 2018-2019, a petition for dependency was filed for the youngest child by the Department of Family and Children's Services. The Ogeechee Judicial Circuit did not have a designated juvenile court judge at that time, so Judge Peed heard all of the matters related to the dependency of the youngest child. We haven't talked about defects for a while, not since 2012, when JR was so badly injured by Mark Wright. Defects didn't file a petition for dependency back then. Are you surprised or confused? DFACS often provides family preservation services without filing a petition with the court. The idea is that the courts should only get involved if there is some thought that the child should be removed from the parent's custody. Given what DFACS should have recognized as Candace and Elwin's lack of protective capacity, some judicial oversight of these kids was warranted back in 2012, but it didn't happen. In the case of the youngest child in 2018, removal was not optional, but that meant Judge Peed was hearing a lot of evidence about the Crockers and their household in conjunction with this petition. At one point, Judge Peed heard evidence that Elwin had made admissions about JR's and Mary's deaths to a counselor designated by the Department of Family and Children's Services to do what is called a comprehensive child and family assessment. At one of the criminal court dates in 2021, Judge Peed made that fact known to the parties. Elwin's criminal attorneys filed a motion to recuse the judge for knowing too much about the case and possibly being biased. At the time I began working in the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit in 2022, this motion to recuse was pending, so no criminal hearings were being scheduled. A judge from another circuit heard the motion and quickly concluded that Judge Peed would be no more biased by his role in the dependency case than he would be by hearing evidentiary motions in the criminal case, so Judge Peed stayed on. But of course, no such evidentiary motions had been heard yet. I failed to mention that friend of the show, Matt Breeden, had gone to work for the Ogeechee Judicial Circuit DA's office in January of 2021. He quickly became involved in the Crocker prosecution, in part due to his work on a death penalty case in Chatham County, which I had done some work on as well. and his familiarity with the Capitol defenders was an added bonus. Matt is unable to participate in this series, but he is sure to be mentioned going forward. The first boilerplate motion hearings on these cases were heard in the spring of 2022, and by April, some orders had actually been filed, over 3 years after the murders were discovered. But 2022 showed some promise of getting the cases on track for trial. For reasons that we'll discuss more in the next episode, I got involved in the case in July of 2022. This gave me a front row seat to the discovery games. As I mentioned before, the state had filed a list of the discovery served on the defense in November of 2020. The list appeared to be complete, but the Capitol defenders were coming to court claiming they didn't have everything. Never one to take things at face value, Matt asked each set of Capitol defenders to provide a 2-terabyte hard drive so that we could copy everything we had onto it and make a copy for the clerk's file. Court dates would come and go with no hard drives exchanged, but plenty of complaints about what had or had not previously been turned over. By May of 2023, I'd had enough. I drafted a motion to enforce the court's orders. At this point, the Capitol defenders had been in defiance of 13 scheduling orders. They had failed to file all of their motions. They had failed to engage in reciprocal discovery, claiming that they couldn't do anything until they received full discovery from the state, which, of course, they were trying very hard not to get. I should add that even when they were provided with discovery on these terabyte hard drives, the complaints in court were things like, we can't tell what's new and what's old. There are a lot of pages here. There might be just one thing different. They need to tell us what's different from what we previously received. So basically, they don't have to do any work at all. It is entirely on the state to do everything for them. Shortly after the state's motion was filed, Levin's lawyers did bring that 2-terabyte hard drive to the DA's office, and a month or so later, Mark's attorneys did as well. Kim's attorneys didn't bother to do so until January of 2024. Included in the discovery disclosed to Elwin were Elwin's medical records from the facility where he was being housed. DA office investigator Andre Wright, yes, the Andre Wright that is currently in the news for being under a GBI investigation, had been asked to get a search warrant for Elwin's medical records. He didn't do it. Instead, he presented an ex parte order to Judge Peed to get the records, which was the wrong procedure. Legally, a law enforcement officer can have ex parte contact with a judge to swear out things like search warrants or even get ex parte orders. But in this case, one of the few orders Judge Peed had signed was a blanket order preventing any ex parte contact between him and the district attorney's office. I should note, as is an aside, that the Capitol defenders, after nearly every hearing date, would have ex parte hearings with the court and discussions about things we were never allowed to know anything about. But as a result of this mistake by Investigator Wright, another motion to recuse was filed on behalf of Elwin, and this one was granted. In January 2024, Judge Mulder of the Okeechobee Judicial Circuit was assigned to Elwin Crocker's case, and the entirety of that year, not a single hearing was held. Only one status hearing was held on Kim and Mark's cases in 2024. That was held by Judge Peed. And at the end of 2024, Judge Peed retired, having entered orders on 47 of the 125 motions filed in the Crocker case. He had held evidentiary hearings on some of the motions to suppress evidence, but had not ruled on them. And that was for months, even before the last motion to recuse was filed. While there are rules in place about judges ruling on motions within 90 days, it is the moving party, in this instance, Elwin Crocker, that has standing to press this issue. And Elwin Crocker did not want the court to rule on his case, ever. In January 2025, newly elected Judge Matt Hubie took the bench in Judge Peed's place. And there was a newly elected district attorney in place as well, Robert Busby. Elwin Crocker's case was transferred from Judge Mulder to Judge Hubie so that all of the cases would be in front of the same judge. And there was some hope that the case might get moving. After all, it had only been 6 years since these murders were discovered and investigated. What could possibly slow things down now? Have you been paying attention to me talking about the Capitol defenders for how long this has been taking? Judge Hubie entered orders on all of the motions Judge Peed had heard but not decided by early June of 2025. Hearing dates were scheduled beginning in May of 2025, but the gamesmanship began again. The Capitol defenders claimed not to have everything in discovery, but they still couldn't say what they thought was missing from the state's discovery that had been served to them. They appeared for evidentiary hearings where they said they planned to have witnesses testify, just to show up to complain that they thought the date was just a status conference and they didn't have their witness. Their arguments about the admissibility of photographs being too gruesome were circular, saying that they didn't know which photos might be used. There were too many for them to go through. I mean, they'd only have them for 6 years. So they wanted the state to essentially make their arguments for them. I don't want to spend too much time on the other cases that were still pending, but evidentiary hearings were begun on Mark Wright's case in August of 2025, with accusations being made about grand jury proceedings and evidence reflecting all of the specious allegations made in Mark Wright's legally insufficient motions going against Mark over and over. Things were finally moving when the newly elected district attorney got involved. We will talk more about that in the next episode. But without listening to the prosecutors who had been working on this case for years, the elected DA allowed Mark Wright to plead guilty to lesser charges. He also negotiated a plea with Kim Wright to life without parole in exchange for testimony, and Roy Prater died in early 2026, leaving just Elwin Crocker to be tried. 7 years of delay, and Elwin Crocker's case was not really any closer to trial. How could I say that? I mean, we'd had hearings, right? But there were still evidentiary motions regarding DNA to be heard. And under the unified appeal, remember that thing we talked about at the beginning? Every single ruling by the court had to be looked at by the trial court and then sent up for review by the Georgia Supreme Court. Yes, the whole point of the unified appeal procedure was twofold: to ensure attorneys were talking to their clients throughout the court process, and to make sure that any legal or evidentiary issues could be corrected pre-trial. The capital defenders instruct their clients not to answer the question about the services of the attorney, so that purpose is subverted. But the pretrial appeal is not something that is easy to get around, and that appeal itself can take a whole year. The DNA motions weren't even scheduled until April of 2026. A whole file review is required before the case goes up on appeal, so the earliest jury selection could have started for Elwin Crocker was probably June of 2027. Instead, the death penalty was taken off the table by District Attorney Busby. Elwin Crocker was allowed to plead guilty to life without parole without having his actions aired out in court or his sentence decided by the people of Effingham County. So you have to ask yourself, was this insane delay necessary? Is it just the way things have to be with death penalty cases? Not if the courts had bothered to follow the law. For example, one of the criminals who hijacked a prison bus and killed the prison guards in Putnam County in July 2017 was tried, convicted, and the death penalty imposed by June of 2022. All aspects of the unified appeal were followed. The trial was done in 5 years. So delays, fading memories, and the effects created by the death of Roy Prater were all at the hands of the judges, who didn't care enough about the importance of the trials, not just for defendants, but also for victims' families, law enforcement, and the community, to ensure timely justice for these children. Just an added footnote about the courts on the civil side. The probate judge in Effingham County, a non-lawyer, allowed an attorney with no relationship to the Crocker family or the children to create and administer an estate on their behalf, including allowing this attorney to sue on behalf of the estates. Some of these civil lawsuits against various entities like Walmart and the Department of Family and Children Services may still be pending. At least one discovery dispute on one of the cases was recently argued before the Georgia Court of Appeals, trying to pin some sort of fault on a school counselor who had conveyed a report about JR to law enforcement in 2017. It's something we mentioned before. While I don't think anyone would question that the youngest child, who is now an adult, has certainly been through a lot and may be entitled to recover something civilly from this whole hellacious experience, the idea of some random attorney profiting from these children's deaths is sickening. Yet no one in the court system seems to see a problem. For those who have been wondering, you now know why these cases took so long to get to any kind of hearing. Fear, apathy, and a lack of diligence on the part of the courts. The DA's office had choices in how it would respond. Find out what really happened. Stay tuned.